Welcome to this episode of what we're now calling the Uncharted 90s podcast, where we're going to focus on some of the bands from the 90s. And I'm joined, you'll all be pleased to know, by my good mate Noel. How you doing, Noel?
Back again. Yep, all good.
Love it. So today we are focusing on a band that you and I know absolutely love, which is a band called Crashland. Got all the gen on the band, so what's their story?
Right, I shall tell you, my friend. So Crashland were a sort of melodic indie rock kind of band. They originated from Wales, and they've got loads of great songs. And we, as you said, we both think they're way underrated. They were really, really good. It's the lead singer and the main guy and the main songwriter is Alex Troop. And he went on after Crashland to LA, to Los Angeles, where he started a new band called Troop. And we'll be talking to him later, actually. So looking forward to that.
We will. And what I would say is that Crashland are one of those bands that, and I know we've said it a few times in season one around some of the 80s bands, but they are the classic Uncharted 90s band where, you know, maybe people haven't heard of them. Maybe they might have heard a song or two, but in reality, they should have been huge, in my view.
And mine, definitely. So the band members were Alex Troop, who was vocals and guitar, Mark Childs on drums, and Martin Madiford on bass. So Alex and Mark actually met at school in Monmouth in Wales when they were 14. Now, at that time, I read that they were both into heavy metal. Stuff like AC/DC and Iron Maiden.
So 96 then, that would have been probably, what, in the middle of Britpop or towards the end of Britpop?
Kind of probably towards the end, because I think Britpop was kind of probably at its peak in 95. Didn't 94, 95, wasn't it, I guess?
Right.
So it was sort of slightly the back end of it, or maybe, you know, still going, but they were just starting at that time. So both Alex and Mark had played previously in a band called Scorched Earth with Alex's brother Andy on lead vocals. And as you say, in 96, this is where the Crashland story really begins. So they were now sort of by now playing kind of 3 minute sort of radio friendly kind of indie Britpop type songs. Mark was on drums, obviously Alex was on guitar. They needed a bassist, so they got Martin Manafort, and the way they got him was they put an advert in Melody Maker. So that's quite interesting. That's the point decided on the name Crashland as well. Yeah, we talked to the Skids, and of course their drummer was they advertised for him in the local press up in Dunfermline. So, yeah, they even had a mission statement actually, which was to offer a wake up call you won't be able to ignore. So that was kind of like making a real statement there.
What a great mission statement! I'd be interested to see how they got that name. So that maybe that's something we can ask.
Yes. In 97, a demo was recorded for EMI, which got circulated around London for a while. And it fell into the hands of a label called Independiente. So Independiente signed to the band on June the 4th, 88. Actually, but sadly, for that whole period, Crashland never actually got a John Peel session, which is quite unusual, like a lot of the bands we've spoken to.
Yeah. That was because in the sort of later years, Peel wasn't as prolific, maybe. I'm not quite sure when he finished, maybe late 90s. Well, he was still going, I think, then, wasn't he?
I think he went into the early 2000s, but whether the quantity of them dropped off, I don't know, the number that he did each year or whatever. But I was interested on the Peel sessions, because when we do these chats, I was looking at Peel sessions, and I thought whenever he's turned the radio on, he was always playing a band he loved called Half Man, Half Biscuit.
Yeah.
And I thought, I wonder how many Peel sessions they'd had. Yeah, and they'd done 12 Peel sessions. So I thought that's got to be the probably one of the most ever.
Obviously, the four had loads as well, didn't they?
They the this is not going to tell you actually the four did 24 peel sessions. So now we're moving on to 2000 now. Having to cut their teeth gigging, they were actually described for a very short period by NME as the next best thing. Now,
Ah,
that's always a bit of poison chalice, isn't it? Because as soon as they build you up, they want to knock you down again.
yeah,
Yeah.
and they were very good at that enemy, weren't
Oh, yes, absolutely.
they?
At the end of May the 2000, the BBC recorded a whole concert in Cardiff for broadcast, which has since been repeated several times, most recently on Six Music. And in June, they released their first single, which is called New Perfume.
You drop the bomb, and I feel like I've never had a feeling. Since you decided you were leaving, then every day's been such a bad day. Staying indoors and awake for my youth, I turn the lights out. I hear somebody read my rights out. I know it's you, you read my rights out. You said you had to get away. That's what you say, oh, oh yeah. You said it's been a long time. Oh, it's been a long time. Carbonated youth full of fizz, that's the truth, but it goes soon. You're gonna smell a new perfume. You're gonna smell a new perfume.
Great song.
Mega, mega song, but it only reached 96 in the chart. Can you believe?
Well,
But they were,
I don't know whether that was about, can't have been about the quality of the song. Maybe that was about their promotion or about radio play or lack of or whatever.
you'd think so, wouldn't you? I mean, they continued gigging throughout the summer. They were playing in major festivals in the UK. They played in Glastonbury, Tea in the Park, Reading, and Leeds. So they played some massive festivals. They did support slots for Muse, Coldplay, Queens of the Stone Age. I mean, they really got around a lot. So when October came around and they issued their second single, which was called Modern Animal. Just to help me learn to read. Cause there's a magazine and it tells me about the things that I need. Yeah, the pictures make me feel good. I don't do those things but I could. Cause I'm a modern man and I'm trying everything that I can. I had an accident this morning, now I'm stuck in bed. It only reached number 96 in the chart, despite a good review in the NME. NME basically said, "Look, this isn't the single that's going to break the band," is what they said. It's not going to do them, good favors. But they could potentially be the jam for the 21st century. So they said, "There's definitely potential there."
I might be saying this a lot, actually, as I
Yeah,
did, I think, in the
yeah,
TV21 episode, but that is a great song
yeah,
too.
yeah. I mean, the NME said their live set is an explosion of weird, unbridled energy. And they also said their forthcoming album, Glued, should jolt a few people into realizing how interesting this band had become when no one was watching.
Yeah, well, that's
That's what they
true.
said. Yeah, and we saw them, didn't we? You and I
We did.
saw them in Northampton.
And did the jolt happen?
Yeah, this is it. This is the question. What do you think? Nah, sadly not.
No.
No, really sadly not. I mean, their debut album, Glued, hasn't got a bad song on it. Great songs all. It's released in 2000. It's been described as having radio-friendly indie tracks, which were fashionable in the Britpop era. The problem was they were kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time because, as you mentioned about Britpop, it kind of pretty much lost its favor by 2000. So people weren't as keen on buying that kind of music anymore. And actually, there was a lot of interest in bands like the Strokes and the White Stripes coming through. So
Right.
one of the things I picked up was a little flyer, which was from the label, talking about the great they were. And there was, and also there was a little postcard thing they used to give out with a mailing address. You could fill your details in and send it in. So, but they were obviously there was some promotion there to go with it. And in fact, I also have a promo copy of their album as well. So, there's promo stuff around. This is a shocking stat that I found out. Glued only sold 12,000 copies. Can you believe that?
I've got one of them.
I've got one of them. So
I
there you go. But that's and it only
mean,
reached 125 in the album chart. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
I can't believe that. That, I mean, they are a lost band waiting to be discovered
They
still.
really are.
You
Really
know,
are. Really are.
yeah.
I mean that
Maybe a vinyl reissue is in order.
But what happened was that, and I'm really pleased this is the last time I have to say this name actually, because the poor record sales meant that Crashland were inevitably dropped by Independiente.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Last time I had to say it.
Oh.
In 2001, Martin left the band and he was replaced on bass by Stuart Morgan. And they got an additional guitarist, Nicky Fowler, and recorded a four-track EP called Devoted. Didn't get anywhere, but he included some great tracks, including Karaoke Ballad. So in 2003, the band was still hoping to sort of make a name for themselves, and they were given a bit of a false hope, actually. An American record company offered to fly them over for a showcase in LA, but the offer was withdrawn. However, they'd already made the plans. So they went out to LA and did manage to play to some of the labels, but sadly, nothing was forthcoming. And actually, that's when they formally called a day for the band. Crashland was over.
I could see their sound was you could say it was quite American, couldn't you?
You
I'm
could certainly,
surprised that they
when you
that
hear the later stuff that Alex done, definitely you can see how that works together. Yeah. But in a kind of seamless link from Crashland to Troop, what happened was that I think that trip inspired Alex. He liked LA so much that he later relocated to LA. So, yeah, so now we're on the band Troop. So he moved in 2006, he moved to LA, and there was a massive indie rock scene there. So it was pretty cool for him to arrive into. In the winter of 2006, he met a guitarist called Anthony Dean, and they started to work together with the band. And they had some other guys, including Adam Marcello and Linus Dodson, playing with them. But then, moving on 3 years, he was in a record shop in LA. It's a bit of an LA institution, I think, called Amoeba Records, browsing through the vinyl. And he got chatting with a guy there called Evan Beagle. Now, Evan Beagle is a record producer and a keyboard player. And they sort of agreed to start working together. So by this point, they had a guitarist, Claudio Tristano, bassist, Darren Thomas Maguire, and drummer, Brandon Davis. So it was a different lineup. What was interesting about them was that they all shared a love of classic 70s rock, synthesizers, and Britpop. And apparently, they played at classic venues around LA. And have since, well, and were described at the time as having a killer live show. So that's pretty good, isn't it? In 2012, Edge of the World was one of their songs, got released, and the video was released for it. And Troop got positive reviews on some various LA sort of band sites, including BuzzBands. It's a great song as well, Edge of the World. 2013, they actually released an album called Last Chance for Romance. Like everything Alex has done, there's not a bad track on there. You know, every song he's ever done is great. You know, sometimes even with bands we love, there's a dodgy track here and there, but no, not at all with him. They're all good, really good stuff. Then moving on, in 2016, they issued an EP, released an EP called Mercury in Gold, and that includes a mega song called Always on Fire. And in 2017, they were trying to get a record deal by promoting a song called Rag and Bone Man, but sadly, no deal was forthcoming. So they pretty much have gone quiet since then. So, be interested to hear whether the project is over, whether it's a hiatus, or what the situation is of late when we speak to Alex.
Yeah, great songwriter.
Absolutely, absolutely. But We're on Fire by Crashland was I one of the things one of the reviews I looked at described it as yesterday for our generation. You know, they said, and in brackets, no, really. I mean, it really is a great song.
Okay, well, why don't we now have a chat with Alex, and we can maybe get answers to some of those questions.
Fantastic.
Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Could you start for us by giving us a bit about your background and your influences before you got into music?
Influences. I don't know, the bands I like influenced me, or the bands I was listening to when I was very young influenced me. I suppose they did. My sister was playing Black Sabbath, Rush, The Eagles, all kinds of 80s hard rock and metal. I think my mum was playing Rubber Soul. When I remember from a very probably my earliest memory was something like some stuff off Rubber Soul. And then in school, as I got a bit older, it was all metal. It was sort of all the kids where I grew up, where the metal was big. So I was into AC/DC, Iron Maiden, Metallica's, I think Master of Puppets was coming out when I was sort of formative. Well, 13, 14 in school, all the kids were drawing Metallica logos on their exercise books. And so it was metal madness. Lots of metal in the village discos and school discos around where I grew up. After that, when I started getting playing guitar, 15, 16, started getting into, all the kids were playing. I was hanging out with them, playing the blues and playing, discovering older stuff like that. And Mark, my mate, the drummer in Crashland, he was my best mate. I think he was playing Led Zepp at the time, and he introduced me to some Led Zepp stuff. So yeah, just a ton of stuff. My background, yeah, that's it, I suppose. Yeah, there you go.
I think initially, was it your brother that you started out with?
Well, we had a band. Yeah, we had a local band. But anybody at school or in the village who wanted to play, and like everybody was playing guitar. We played, local village hall discos. People would come and watch us. So we had a bunch of different bands over the years. Teenage years. Yeah, my brother was playing rhythm guitar for a while. This was in Monmouth, and then we all took the plunge and decided to move to the big city, which in this case, I think our manager had a connection in Bristol, which was just across the channel from us in South Wales. And he had the camper van and, some hookups over there. So we decided to go to Bristol rather than Cardiff. Those were, I suppose, the two options for the big smoke from where I grew up. And yeah, we went over and lived in a band house for a bit. And put a band together. My brother was singing, and I was back up and writing some songs. Mark was drumming in that band. We had a different bass player back then, a guy called Ben Smith, who was a great bass player. And we had a lot of fun, you know, touring around the local area in the back of a Toyota camper van. It was a dream.
So you got Martin, I think, through an advert in Melody Maker.
Yeah, we did. The band I was just talking about, we sort of split up, broke up, got a bit disillusioned. I did. We travelled down to London, showcased a lot, and did everything the A&R guys required of us. Drove down in rush hour to London, turned up at some, you know, empty pub at 6:30, loaded in, and waited patiently for the A&R guy to come and watch the band as he'd promised. And of course, they never showed up, and they never came down. And you used to do it quite a lot, and pretty soon realised it was pretty soul destroying. And so took a break from it, decided to give it a shot again. But this time I was, I sort of made the decision not to go to London and to focus more on Bristol. And, you know, the TJ's in Newport, I think we played, well, I think the Eiffel back in Cardiff was open at that point. Bristol had a couple of great venues. There was one called the Louisiana, which is still going, the upstairs room in there. I think it's still going, still run by, same family, I think. It's an Italian guy that was running that pub, and a lovely guy. And still one of the best meals you get before a gig to this day, I would imagine. But we used to play the Louisiana, the Louis, and Phil. We started to get busy in there. We started to fill that. And then, you know, local promoters would get wind of it. And we played the Fleece and Birkin a lot. We do, you know, it's a big venue for a small band, but we do a couple of hundred at least in there. And, you know, as soon as you start turning heads locally, then I guess all these people are in contact, aren't they? So the promoters of Bristol, the powers that be, the word would get out to the people in London. Then they'd start to call us up and sniff around. And, you know, I think I was savvy enough to be quite distant and sort of ignore them and not return their calls. And then they'd start to come and see us. And then, you know, you start that element and mystique about the band. And that's how that happened. So when we decided to form Crashland, it really wasn't a massive slog before we started getting a lot of interest. We slogged in the band before. I mean, we slogged when we got signed, but to get the interest, it was probably all within about 6 or 8 months, you know, kind of few key shows, and they started sniffing around, you know, and showing some heavy interest. Martin, we got from an advert, I can't remember the wording, but it's probably, you know, slightly arrogant and aloof, and, you know, telling him we were intent on going places, and that was it. He came to Bristol, get a quick audition, seemed to be a good fit. You know, we gelled pretty well in the rehearsal studio. We were playing out of a studio then. And I think a mate of mine, a guy called Norm Wilson, had a studio called Unit 3 in Bedminster. And didn't charge me and Mark any money for a long, long time. God bless him. So we had a really nice rehearsal room for free for, well, years, really. And he sort of said, well, it's all right. Just put it on the tab. And, you know, was lucky enough to get a deal and wander down there with a bag full of cash, you know, at the time, which is a great memory. But he was a generous, I think bands need that, you know, need someone to help you out. And he helped us out with, you know, probably thousands of pounds worth of rehearsal, really, that at that point. So that was a lovely thing to do.
And where did your name come from?
It was came at the final hour, I think. We played a couple of shows outside. I think we played a show in Taunton. You know, we were really quite, we planned it. We didn't want to touch down in the Louisiana or the Fleece or anything. Word was getting around. We did a sort of warm-up first gig, we did in Taunton. We didn't have a band name. It went well. A lot of our friends came down from Bristol. We had great support amongst friends, family, and all kinds of fans, you know, from old bands in Bristol. And they all came down to Taunton. We had a great show. It was euphoric. Needed a band name, didn't have one, scratching around with all kinds of different things. I think in the end, we were sitting around a cup of tea at my place one afternoon. Martin got the dictionary out and was just diligently going through words in the dictionary. Unfortunately, it's no more glamorous than that. And he happened upon Crashland, and there we are. That was it.
Fantastic.
Never my intention, but now that you wasting. I was dreaming, and I'll dream till you come and wake me. 'Cause you make me feel how I wanna feel. And if I seem strange, it's 'cause you're so real. Your philosophy is confusing me. Your philosophy, well, it's losing me. Come on, come on, you know that I'm waiting for you. Come on.
You mentioned TJ's in Newport. Actually, a previous band that we had on a podcast was the Darling Buds. They're from kind of Usk Monmouth area, so they played there quite a lot as well. So a bit of a cross reference to those guys as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think TJ's had a great reputation for punk. I know Nana played there. There was a band called the 60 Foot Dolls that kind of made it out of the Newport scene, and we played TJ's, and we also played some. I think the singer Richard Parfitt came over to see us play in Bristol, which was a lovely endorsement from a sort of similar power pop, if you will, three piece. And I think they had a really strong EP. Happy Shopper was out at the time or something. Their album was about to be released. And we got a gig at TJ's. He came down and said hi, you know, and was it was nice to get that sort of endorsement. And, you know, amongst the pretty rife, competitive, sulky behavior between musicians of that era. But yeah, TJ's was there. Quite a venue. It sort of had a cave-like interior. Looked like a massive nostril. I was. I remember playing there. We supported Manson once. Crashland supported Manson once. We were locked out of the venue for some time. I guess it was their policy to have the set for themselves without any interference from support bands. Yeah, it was one of my memories of TJ's, but. Great little venue, great sound, you know, real punk venue, you know.
So I wanted to ask you about, so you recorded the demo. I read that you recorded it for EMI, but then it got sent around to other record companies before you got signed by Independiente. But what tracks are on that? And why
Good question.
Them up?
I know Modern Animals on it. I think we had a song called Tongueless. I don't know if that ever came out. Third song, I think, was... a song called Waiting for Someone, which is a sort of Bowie-esque.
Maybe I just got here too late. Everyone seems out of their mind. They say they think this century is great. I can't wait to leave it behind. Oh, maybe it was something I said. Or I should do something instead. You should try and see what I see. Maybe you could do what I do. Oh, when I was young, they shouted.
A guy we knew, I think he was working in record distribution, said, oh, I know Mike Smith at EMI Publishing, I think was it. And he said, oh, you want to come down and demo for Mike, you know, in London? And we were like, well, yeah, of course we do. Couldn't believe that, you know, we got such a great invitation so early on. So we went down, did the demo in there. And obviously Mike was known, I think, at the time, probably still is. So he was well respected. Although he didn't pick us up, word got around that Mike had been involved, and you know, that definitely set the wheels in motion. And yeah, that's where we did that particular demo. Yeah, after the Bristol demo, I think we did a demo before that in a studio in Newport. Can't remember the name. It was a guitarist playing for a Welsh band called Novocaine, great punk band. He produced a demo as well, which was probably, you know, got the head turned locally as well. You know, there's a bunch of stuff that goes on here and there. Richard Jackson, he became our sound man for a while after that. And Jacko, and then he was went on to do some production, but he was in the band Overcane. He knew the Dolls and he knew, you know, that whole South Wales scene, which, you know, in hindsight would probably been a better fit for us as a sort of punk pop band. Coming out of Bristol, we were sort of isolated and not really picked up. It was hard for us in Bristol a little bit, and there was a bit more of a scene in Wales. Had we known, we'd have gone there. But you know, we just left on bright eyed, bushy tailed, and like I say, it was sort of a manager's, it was a mate manager. The bloke with the van really decided. The bloke with the camper van told us where we were going to go way back. So that's, you know, it's funny how these things work out, you know.
So before you got signed, were there any other record companies that were kind of interested in you?
Yeah, there were quite a few. I think there was Dave Balfe, who signed Blur to, was it Columbia, I think. There was a few other labels that wanted to put an offer on the table. And why we went with Independiente, I think, was because, you know, we felt right at the time. It seemed like a great place to be. I think we were, you know, somewhat wanted, even though Independiente was only a major label imprint, I think we, some part of that, of our, you know, appeal to a, you know, punk ethic that we didn't want to go straight to major. In hindsight, I'm not sure it would have really mattered, but maybe have been better not to have. But there it is. Yeah, so there was a few labels. Dave Balfe demoed us or courted us.
So did you find that Independiente gave you the support that you expected when you actually signed on the line?
I think we spent too long signing. There was too much negotiation and we were a bit naive. Lawyers got involved. They were mailing bits of paper across London and raising the money was going up. So I think in hindsight, we should have just gone with a lawyer. We would have gone, let's get it done and get on with it. We were like holding out for points on a record in the third term in Japan. If you sell over 100,000 in the Pacific Rim kind of clauses, which it doesn't really do anybody any good because things can always be redone. But yeah, I probably knew a little bit too much about and not enough equally. The relationship with the label, I would say, you know, could have been a bit better when we got involved because we'd spent a little while getting the deal organized. You know, we had a couple of good A&R. Our A&R guy that signed us was a sort of larger than life character and a lovely guy. But I think we got lost in his, you know, he was living the rock and roll lifestyle very much. So he moved on to the next thing. And it was also fairly, you know, like I say, living larger than life. But we got a good relationship over there with a guy that didn't sign us, John Niven. I think he went on, I don't know who he signed at that label. Great character, John. All music, Glaswegian, you know, tour de force, real, really bright guy. He wrote a book about being an R guy in the 90s in London. It's called Kill Your Friends. I think they made a movie of it. There's a chapter in that book that pretty much sums up the existence of a 90s indie rock band that gets courted by a label, gets taken to London, wined and dined, fitted up with a few different producers at great expense. Record doesn't come out. You end up being in massive debt to them. But it's quite well written. You kind of get spat. You find yourself spat back out on the bus station or the train platform where you left a year before. Going back to work in the chippy or in the hardware store, whatever it was, and that's your experience of the music business. Worth a read because it's pretty accurate as to what happened to a lot of the also ran rock and indie bands at that time. I think, you know what I mean.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because these podcasts we've been doing, we spoke to loads of bands, and it's almost like that's like a summary of what their life cycle was pretty much like. Quite often the press would give them a bad start, would firstly build them up, then knock them down. And then you got the record company who kind of let them down or try to change them, actually.
Yeah.
It just sounds very similar, yeah.
Yeah, it could be. You're right. I think John Niven puts it perfectly. I mean, not to knock it. It's, you know, it's lovely to get courted, to get taken to London, to have some money thrown at you, to work with, you know, amazing producers. And but you know, it's a numbers game, and you know, you're often at the whim of, you know, somebody's ego wants to, you know, and you may be not as malleable as they think you should be. I mean, I remember we worked with, they were trying to fit us with a producer, and so we worked initially with, I think we did a demo at Courthouse with the, I think it was like Radiohead's engineer, and that turned out great, but they wanted a name producer, so we went to Mono Valley, which is the sort of sister studio of Rockfield in Monmouth, where me and Mark came from. So it was just kind of lovely to go back there and signed as a pro. They put us in with a guy called Phil Vinyl, who, you know, great producer, just made, one of Placebo's early records and done some other stuff with Black Box Recorder. But he wanted to change a little bit. He, you know, we ended up I think Dan Deliverfe, he tried to change the time signature on it, and we almost ended up with a sort of, half reggae ska beat, which he sort of managed to get us to do. Stick to your guns to a degree, but it's sometimes you get talked into doing stuff. So that wasn't great. Label didn't want that. When they moved us on to, we had a meeting with, I think, Chris Kimsey, who made a great Stones record and was working as an engineer on some of the really big late 70s, early 80s Stones records. Never got in a studio with him, but had a great meeting with him, wanted to work with him, and that somehow didn't materialize. We met the guys who made the first Stereophonics record. I mean, Bird and Bush, I think they could have been on. It's just a litany of potential relationships with producers that you want, or maybe the label wants you to have, and you never really know who's gonna. You're certainly not gonna pull the trigger on it and make it happen. And then it was getting on a bit and going on and on and on a bit, and eventually we were happy to have interest from Paul Tipler after he made an Idlewild record, I think, and he was just very no nonsense. I know the studio. It's not going to break the bank. It's not hard. You're hard little punk band. Let's get in there and make the record. And so that was music to everybody's ears at that point. I think we cut ties with our hometown manager. We tried to get a big management company involved. We got some interest from a guy called Merck Mercuriadis. He was kind of a monster manager. He'd been working for Sanctuary, Iron Maiden, very strong, independent, powerful operation. And he came on board and he was really interested in the band. He put us in a studio with Bob Ezrin, of all people, who was in town in London. So we were fortunate enough to go and do a studio session, short rehearsal session, essentially, with, the producer of The Wall and many other great records. And he came in and he just got his hands into their arrangement of the songs really quick. And he seemed fantastic. We were just all overjoyed. That we had maybe a big time management company and then this huge hitting American producer to get us going. And then label didn't want it. So it's just those types of stories everywhere. I don't know. Clash of egos, too much money, but good for trying, but who say Ezra would have made a better glue than Paul? I mean, I think stood the test of time. So, no regrets. We're definitely happy with the outcome.
We're on Fire is an amazing song, isn't it? We're on Fire.
We're on Fire. Well, thanks. Yeah, that's I think I recorded that on I borrowed a pre-war Martin 0018 guitar for that. Andy McDonald, who was the head of the record label, and I think after a few beers one night, my old Telecaster dropped on it, and I pop a hole in there. The top of it with a tuning peg, so but still sounded great. But I don't think he was too happy with me after that. But
no,
these things happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I could get a word or two into this or into you, beaming like a mirror ball, cause everybody's in your hall. Thrilled to see so many make a long haul, to see your cake, to what you pick, to sell a tape, to what you fit, to what you fake. More than one or two forget to spell your name or leave an epithet. You act as if you're upset, we don't know what you're waiting for. I don't live that far away, and I can visit any day. Tonight we're the actors, local overreactors. Yeah, we're on fire. We just don't know if it's love or if it's just desire. I expected more than this, something more than just a kiss.
NME seemed to really love you, didn't they? They seemed to really sort of say like you were the next best thing. I just wonder how that impacted on you or the band, if at all.
Yeah, well, massive impact. When we all used to read it, I think, you know, like it or not, you know, everybody was, those papers were influential, you know, for good reason. And happy to be, we were happy to be loved by the NME. We got some great reviews. We got some good interest. They chucked us on the cover, I think, with, there was a tour, four bands went out and toured Coldplay. We were on the cover with those other three bands. And that was a great thing to be, you know, to be touted as, are these the best new bands in Britain, I think was the headline. Great to have it. But, you know, there's always a sting in the tail. There's many different journalists over there. And I think there's lots of, as much as one guy might like you and they might, you know, they're in business too. They want to sell paper. So they've got to keep it, you know, they've got to keep the interest alive with new bands and new things happening and new tales of drunkenness and debauchery and all the rest of it. Yeah, they liked us to a point. I think I got a sort of lukewarm interview at one point when the record came out, which was probably not the best timing for us. But such is life.
Because New Perfume, it sort of almost feels inconceivable that it wasn't a much bigger song, bearing in mind the sort of profile that you had, you know, in the press. Do you think there's a particular reason for that?
Hard to say. Yeah, I mean, I don't think the label Travis were late bandmates. They were, you know, selling a lot of records at the time. I think it's fair to say we weren't therefore getting the full support of the record label or our A&R guy. I think we checked into rehab around the time our first single came out. I think New Perfume stands up. It's definitely a catchy song with a hook. It's a good tune. You know. I don't know. It's just a case of, you know, you got to be lucky. You got to be there at the right time. You know, everything's got to be aligned. I'm not sure if our, you know, PR was as good as it could have been. I don't know really. Whether we could have got a better time tour at the time. But yeah, the product was there, I think. You know, we were ready to go. I mean, you can level arguments against bands, you know, later down the line. But I think, you know, that we delivered for a first album. There was definitely a couple of singles on it. But yeah, why? I think we made, Lamac was a good supporter of ours. The radio went B list, but we didn't make the A list. I think it was vetoed from the A list for some reason. I don't know who did it.
Because Glued, you know, I mean, I think that still stands up today as an album.
Yeah,
that
so do I. Thank you.
No, honestly, every time we don't think there's a bad song on it, but actually there's tunes on that album all the way through.
Well, thanks. Yeah, this, it's, you know, I think it stands the test of time. You know, it's a good first record. It's a great debut. No question.
Cause I want my snow.
Also, that didn't quite make the sales charts, did it? I mean, I just wondered, is it the same thing for the single, or is it something else? Just one of those things?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's what do you need? I suppose you need a good song and a good band to go out there and do it. You also need good airplay. You probably need good press, good advertising, you know, and a sort of well-aligned release date with a well-timed tour for the promoting the release. And I don't think the tour and the agent were particularly well-aligned with the label. You know, those are the issues, I think. It was mismanaged, you know. Was it, who was leading that? Well, the A&R guy and the manager, I guess. Were they that well-aligned? No, hard to be aligned with an A&R guy who's going through some issues. But the label were not fully behind the band because they had a bigger fish to fry at the time. So yeah, I think those are the reasons. I don't, you know, I mean, I've thought about it a few times over my life, but I don't lose sleep over it anymore. But yeah, you know, it's just, and I've known people, you know, I know people that have similar stories, and it does happen, you know. So you know, at one point you think, well, you know, that should have been us, but there's a lot of bands out there that are very similar stories, and I think it's to do with those things, you know. Those are all those elements need to be there, you know, and that, and if one of them isn't, or, and then you also need luck. But I think, yeah, you need a good solid UK tour to promote the release of an album or a single, you know, and it needs to be well advertised, and you need to be, you know, pushed and promoted in those areas. And I'm not sure we got that from our, you know, booking agent. And I'm not blaming the agent, you know, the money comes out of the label often. And you know, maybe the management was breaking down at the time. You know, we didn't really feel like we had a manager who was equipped for that side of it. He was, you know, probably really good at finding a band, scouting and taking a band to that point, but probably not good at dealing with a signed band. Maybe as a band, we could have recognized that earlier and try and put ourselves in, you know, which we did after, in the hands of someone more capable of dealing with that sort of initial push of a band with decent product. Don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. That would be my answer, but feel free to pick my brains anymore.
So do you still own the rights to Glued, or does someone else or the record company own it?
Well, the masters, I'm not sure. The masters will be owned by the label for a period of time. I did mean to look into that. I think it was it 20, 25 years, something like that. So it might be coming up for, I don't know where they go after that. I would need to talk to my old lawyer, which I certainly own the you know, the publishing, the copyright on it.
I think we need a sort of vinyl reissue out on that one.
Yeah, we've been thinking about it. There was some talk of 20th anniversary doing something, and, you know, maybe putting a little tour together or something in the UK. But then the pandemic sort of did for that. And, you know, I'm over here now. It's tricky to get it organised, and, you know, financially. But, yeah, it would be nice to revisit it and do something with it. Yeah, it's definitely...
Well, if you get to that stage, we'll be right there for you. I can tell you that.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. Thank you so much, gentlemen. That's very kind.
So what was it like playing Glastonbury?
Well, it was unique, I suppose. We were the first band on, not the Pyramid, I think second stage or whatever it was called then. I think we were on like 11 or maybe half past 10. So, you know, people crawling out of their tents with hangovers and looking for, you know, donuts and coffee or whatever. You know what I mean? So when we got on stage, it wasn't really anybody under the stage, I don't think. I remember shouting wakey wakey as loud as I could on the mic. And then, you know, down from the hills descended, you know, people, some fans started to come down. So that was good. And they filled out a little bit during the set. Yeah, it was great to open that stage on that day. I think it was a Saturday morning. And then we were followed by Coldplay. We didn't know that well. I think the drum, we bumped into him a couple of times and, you know, chat, nice enough guys. I remember drummer being a nice guy, having a chat with him in the club I've been in Cardiff twice. So they went on after us, you know. So that was a good memory. I actually bumped into Chris Martin a few years later on. I was working in a restaurant in Santa Monica, nice Italian restaurant, as many musicians do when they got to pay the bills and they are in the music biz. So I'd come over to the States, as you know, and got a job working in an Italian restaurant, and who should walk in? Gwyneth Paltrow and her mother, I think it was, and Chris Martin. And he came over and we had a quick chat. I wasn't serving him, luckily. I was more like a maitre d' kind of a host kind of character. So, but yeah, it was nice to catch up with him. It's strange to, you know, strange situation to be in, given that we were both on the front cover of The Enemy at one point and we opened Glastonbury and then they followed. You know, we had a nice little chat and that was nice.
So as we move then from like Crashland to Troop, how did that transition occur? And what was it like? Did you have any demos or songs, or did it all transition straight to Troop?
Well, it's quite a long time period there, so I'll go over it. Crashland, put Glued out, put the singles out. You know, we weren't really doing well. Everybody'd hoped for us, and then the label eventually dropped us. We've delivered some demos. I guess you could argue the relationship had soured with the label, mainly due to the fact that we were trying to get a manager, a sort of a heavyweight or, you know, a meaningful manager with a reputation and some skills. And it seemed like the label were kind of actively not willing to play ball on that front. And, you know, if we found a manager that was willing to come in, they would sort of deliberately not return calls, or there was a lot of politics involved, you know, and I think they maybe wanted to stipulate who managed us, or maybe didn't care that we were getting rid of their initial manager, who was probably easier for them to handle. So things were going downhill. And similarly, within the band, there were some differences. You know, we weren't happy within the band. So towards the end of the band's commercially wasn't doing well. Me and Mark parted ways with Martin. We found a good management outfit and we hired some new musicians to keep Crashland going. We did a couple of dates in Belgium and the Netherlands with the Strokes, of all people, who were, you know, just coming in to, you know, take over the world, which was great. And we made an EP, kind of a rushed EP, which I don't think, you know, is my best work. I've definitely lost my mojo and my music to a degree. So we made an EP called, although I think Devotion's a good song. We made an EP independently with a Bristol label called the Devoted EP.
I do nothing lately but watch the young with concern for the safety.
Made that with Richard Jackson in the studio, and the aforementioned guitarist, the Novocaine, with in a studio in Cardiff, and we sort of pitched that to, I think there was a Cardiff label at the time, and we were hoping to get picked up by them. Hugh Stevens was running a label in Cardiff. We were hoping to get picked up by him. They showed some interest in it. I think we did it. I think he was affiliated with the studio, but we didn't. He didn't sign us to the label. I think they were a bit more cool and indie, and they didn't want to have a band that had been on a major dropped and then, you know, pick them up. That was my reading of it from Hugh. I think he said to me at the time, we don't want, you know, the big famous Crashland on our label. You know, we're supposed to be a cool little label picking up from the street. So he didn't pick that up. So we put it out on a Bristol label, which didn't do a lot with it. Then we made another demo in the same studio, I think, with Jacko. And that's a solid demo. I'd like to put that out at some point. There's some good tunes on that. I think five tracks we made, never been released. So I would like to get my hands on that and release that.
She was clear as a crystal.
That period, that version of Crashland, if you will, we got some interest from a label in the States. And our manager, Julian, was working to get us with a... They had an affiliate management company in New York, and he was spreading it around. And we got invited to go and showcase in New York for a bunch of major labels, which we did. And then we showcased in LA. I think we flew back from... and at this point, I think Stuart Morgan was playing the bass, and a guy called Nick Fowler was playing guitar for us, who we had also got from the NME, an NME advert, and or maybe Melody Maker. He was in a band called Charlie, a signed Oxford band called Charlie. I don't know if you remember them. They'd broken up, similar circumstances to us, no doubt. And then he answered the advert, came down. We all had a jam, went out for a curry, got absolutely in a terrible state, and then he called up the manager the next day and said he wanted the job, which is a surprise to us all because we'd left him in such a state, poor Nick. Management got us some great showcases in New York. We came over, we played New York, and then I think we flew back to Britain, and within a day or two, we were flying back out to LA. So lots of hope going on, and we played for a bunch of labels, some really quite big names in studio in LA. But, you know, we still remain hopeful, and we did get some interest from a label called Ecstasy Records, which was... an LA label backed by Fuji, the Japanese film company. They signed a band called Abandoned Pools. They were owned by Madonna, or at least co-owned by Madonna. And we did have an offer from them. And I flew over to sign the deal. I remember talking to the boys on the phone. They were going to put us in a house in West Hollywood. I'd seen the house and been talking to the A&R girl for a while. I flew in to LA to sign the deal. And I, on the morning I was going to go in to sign it, I was greeted by a somewhat upset A&R girl, and she took me through to the head honcho of the label, and he said, "Oh, after flying me out, you know, this goes to show how much money they've got," and agreeing a long form contract between, you know, cross Atlantic lawyers. On the day I flew in, he said, "Oh, Fuji have withdrawn the money from Ecstasy. We don't have the money to sign the band anymore. Sorry. Thank you very much. See you later. All the best." And that was a bit of a blow for the band. And I think that's pretty much what did for Crashland at that point. I think we'd all just had enough at that point. I got a taste of American life in Los Angeles at that point. And so that's when I made my decision to come out and continue the journey, as it were. But yeah, that was a tough day, that one.
Yeah, so how did that transition to Troop then?
Well, I came over here on my own. I actually came out with Nick for about 3 months. I think he came out on a tourist visa. And we were still playing, showcasing, making demos. We were hooked up with a guy, Joe Berman, over here, who we met through our manager. He's a radio plugger, essentially, but very helpful to us in those days, trying to get us a deal and help us form a new band. And we played for and showcased and did demos and stuff like that. Nothing came of it. Nick returned to the UK. I stayed, you know, ducking and diving here and there, working for cash and whatnot, until I got my green card. I guess a few years after that, I sat down with an acoustic guitar and decided to write. I felt like I could write a record. So I wrote Last Chance for Romance and met a LA producer called Evan Beagle and made that record with him in his studio. So that was independently done, me and Evan, essentially, and a couple of other players who picked up, some session players. I was fortunate enough to have you know, great session players on that record. Not through choice, I just couldn't find players. You know, when you get a bit older and you're looking for similar players to commit, it's hard to get people to commit past a certain age. And with the experience that you want, I didn't have a network of friends and everything. So Evan put me in touch with Blair Sinter on the drums. Lance Morrison played bass on that record. I think Lance now is playing for Mike Campbell's band, the Dirty Knobs. Mike Campbell of Tom Petty. I think Blair, I think Lance played on Jagged Little Pill, I think. And Blair played on that too, I think. That's how Evan knew them. Though he didn't make that record, he was familiar with them. He did a bunch of work. He made records with session players before, as is often the case with LA producers. You know, they just know who to call and who to bring in. So they did me proud on that. Evan played keys himself and produced and mixed.
There's a story about how you met Evan in a record shop, Amiga Records, which sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
But also there's another sort of thing on the internet which said that you, prior to that, you met a guitarist called Anthony Dean, and it mentions a whole bunch of other names of a band. Is that a sort of false trailer?
Yeah, there was I had a band that was, when Nick left, I had a few songs lying around. They were more, I don't want to say, well, they were more sort of pop-based rock songs. That was an incarnation of Troop then. I was playing with a guy called Anthony Dean. I was playing with a guy called Linus of Hollywood who produced some of that stuff. That was never released. Linus ended up playing bass. Linus plays with, I think, he's an independent artist, but he's a real accomplished hard rock metal player. And he plays bass for Paul Gilbert whenever Gilbert goes out on the road. So he's way, way in advance of me with his chops. But yeah, we made a good record, never mixed it, never released it. But we took that band out, and there was a drummer then playing for me, Adam Marcello, or Marcello as they say, but it's Adam Marcello, who was a sort of I met just playing gigs around LA. Adam then, I think, great drummer, lovely guy. He went on to, I think he's playing with Katy Perry now. He's the music director of Katy Perry. Oh, wow. It's a long time ago. Yeah. I think we're talking about 2005 or something when he played for me. Yeah, I don't know, just got disillusioned with that. I mean, Anthony was, you know, good friend, played great, didn't really materialize that. So, you know, I just went back to the drawing board again, you know, just trying to keep moving for the time. I think I was chasing things on that record. I think I was trying to chase what I thought was rightfully mine. And then I think when Last Chance came along, I thought I was just sort of done chasing. And I thought, well, I'm just going to write like I used to, because I enjoy it and it does something for me spiritually and personally, and tried to get back to that, which is a choice you can make. I was lucky enough to be in a position where I was able to write for pleasure again, as opposed to write because I really needed to be a rock star type thing, you know, after the sort of demise of Crashland. And there's so many times we came close, I think. I was just sort of, it's just hard to close the page on that stuff. I was chasing it, I think, for a while with my writing. And I think Last Chance, I finally just sort of went with how I felt.
It's a great album. You know, we both love it as well. You know, we love the Crashland.
Yeah, thanks. Very different. But I think it stands up. Yeah, it's a solid piece of work, no question.
Yeah, no, it's great stuff.
Another late night spreading goodwill. Breakfast is a tear and the morning after pill. I'm killing that plant on my windowsill. I used to love the girl down the main. She knew that I would fail her, but she loved me just the same. Take me down slow to the wishing well. I'm gonna throw my penny to the depths of hell. For she's as deep as coal. She's the one inside a shell. She's loving me, my girl down the lane. She bites me on my...
You know, we played some great shows. We had that was a good time for us.
What's the sort of sizes of audience you were playing to? What sort of venues?
Not big. I mean, you know, we play the Whiskey or play the Viper or play, you know, other venues, and, you know, a couple of hundred, maybe a bit less. You know, we weren't signed. We had no PR really to speak of. And it was hard. You know, I think it's just hard to get a rock band on the map in LA. You know, everybody's out to do it. And I think we played one big gig on the pier in Santa Monica at some point. We had a good turnout, but it was a sort of, you know, captive audience. Some good reviews, some good critical acclaim. Super. We didn't tour, couldn't get a label to sign us, couldn't get a budget to tour. Tough to get management. We played some solid little shows in smaller clubs in LA, and, you know, played some really good shows. We were a good band.
What's the status now then, Alex, with Troupe? Is it on hiatus or what? Is that the sort of nice way of putting it? I mean,
well, yeah, it's a nice way of putting it. I don't have enough time to make a record that sounds terrible. And I haven't got the muse fully in my camp at the moment for whatever reason. So yeah, but I got some ideas. This talk, I mean, I would love to go back to the UK and make a record with Mark and Nick again, and so, you know, the Crashland Mark II lineup. That would be the fun thing to do, make another Crashland record. We talked about it. You know, these things are just hard to facilitate, you know, when you've limited income and limited time and limited time together, you know.
Are you still writing songs?
Yeah, well, like I say, you know, I have reams of unfinished stuff, but, you know, it's as do most people. It's the final, you know, 10% is really what matters. So, you know, I haven't really had the inclination to get to it. You know, it's hard work, you know, keeping a band together and making records that don't really have an impact significantly commercially, or, you know, so that takes a toll. And I think I'm fairly resilient. I'm always writing and doodling, as it were. So yeah, I'd like to try and formulate the doodles into more realized things at some point, and maybe the next few years I will commit to doing that.
Well, if our episode can be that conduit, I'd be delighted.
Yeah, it's certainly been a catalyst, you know, to a degree. Yeah, it's lovely to have conversations about these old things. Sometimes they just feel like a figment of one's imagination. So it's nice to either meet two men equally as mad as me that agree that it happened. We have a shared fantasy. Thank you so much for indulging my madness.
So if you look back then, Alex, what would you say is your greatest memory?
Let me think. Greatest memory? I don't know. I mean, singular greatest memory? Oh, it's tough. I don't know. You know, maybe working with Bob Ezrin for an afternoon, just to see someone of that stature, as down to earth and easygoing in terms of musical arranging and stuff. You know, tend to put these people on a pedestal and go, you know, they're going to be scrutinize me and make me feel like I'm not worthy and stuff. And then they just breeze in and talk to you as an equal, having made, you know, enormous impactful records in their lives. I think that's a great memory. When we played the BBC Maid of Ale sessions one night, and we went to the Maid of Ale studios, and the BBC got set up by whoever the master engineer is up over there, and, you know, played live as a three-piece. That's a great memory, to just get into that situation, having known all the bands that have done that Maid of Ale session before, to be invited to do it and then just, you know, bang it out live to the radio. I think that's definitely up there as well.
That was on Peel, was it? I don't think it was Peel, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was a Maid of Ale session. Yeah, I don't know who introduced it. I don't know which DJ introduced it. I mean, the session was recorded by the Maid of Ale guys, and, you know, that, I forget his name, the engineer over there. I think we did a cover of Hanging on the Telephone by Blondie. I'm in the phone booth, it's a one across the hall. If you don't answer, I just ring it off the wall. I know she's there. So that was great to be invited to do that, and then, you know, set up and do it. That's a great memory to do something, you know, live like that, you know, just to go out to be broadcast live like that is a great memory, you know.
All right, brilliant. Look, I'm conscious of the time we've taken. We really appreciate it, Alex. It's been a genuine joy to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Likewise. Yeah, very welcome. I did want to put a footnote in. In one of you, a huge Dave Edmunds fan?
Yeah, I'm a Dave Edmunds fan.
So when I grew up in, I was living in a little village in South Wales called Llanarth, which is a few miles outside of Monmouth, between Monmouth and Abergavenny. Dave was living in Llanarth, and I was probably eight or nine. And we were going around trick-or-treating, knocking on the doors, and we went, and we knew he had a slight, you know, he had a nice little house in the village of Llanarth next to the cricket pitch there, beautiful cricket pitch. And knocked on his door Halloween, gave us 50 quid.
What?
He gave us 50 quid. Look, lovely old Dave. So yeah, it was about five or six of us. So we split that and couldn't believe our luck. What a legend. There was a few people before I picked up a guitar, probably in Monmouth. There was a guy called Paul Martinez. He was... who I got to play with when I was about 17 or 18. He was lovely to me. He was sort of a mentor and took me under his wing a bit. I think he just played the Live Aid show with Led Zeppelin for Stairway to Heaven because, you know, they had no bass. John Paul Jones would be on the keyboards for that. So he'd done a Live Aid gig, and then he was up for doing the Stones gig. I think he got down to the last couple in the audition, but a real character in the Monmouth music scene. And he would play with Robert Plant and Dave Edmunds and all those Rockfield studio jams down there. So there was a lot of that going on. It was nice to meet him and have him take me under his wing. I didn't really get to play or meet with Dave Edmunds, but I did get 50 quid off him Halloween when I was a few years before that, which I thought sums the man up, really, you know?
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you might have blown some dust off things and be the catalyst in me getting a bit more motivated to revisit some of this stuff. So thank you both very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Now, as you know, we do our research from a variety of sources, but if you want to add any more detail for us or even correct us on anything, then please do get in touch with us. Where can they get in touch with us, Noel?
They can contact us on our email address, which is unchartedsoundspodcast@gmail.com.
And of course, you can also get in touch with us on our Facebook group, the Uncharted Sounds group, as well as our Facebook page, the Uncharted Sounds page. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.